2067 is a podcast about the future, seen through the lens of emerging research interests at Concordia University. How do we imagine the future? In the 50s and 60s, there was a creative imagining of technology as well as the future, most of it utopian. Think images of flying cars, cities under glass, helpful robots, aluminum clothing, and personal jetpacks. Some of these ideas about the future were not so far off. But what inspires our future thinking now? Can we use university research to imagine new possibilities? Can we speculate along with researchers about what's next? What's in our future? This is 2067. Look back at images of what we thought the future might be. You know, those images from the 50s and 60s with people getting around via jetpacks. Futurism has always had a fascination with transport. Will we all be flying around with jetpacks strapped to our backs in 2067? Or is the future of transit on two wheels?
I'm Zachary Patterson. I'm a professor in the Department of Geography, Planning, and the Environment. And I specialize in transportation planning. There seems to be an assumption that we will have automated vehicles, autonomous vehicles. And that's what people will be driving around in. The period of time before that happens, that's a subject of debate. It's been 30 years for the past 100 years. And then people have done studies on this, that if you ask how many years in the future will it be until we have cars that are autonomous, the answer is almost always 30 years. But nowadays, it seems to be much closer than that, somewhere between 5 and 10 years. Before the middle of the 19th century, people's main mode of transportation was either by foot or by horse. And that resulted in urban structures. People needed to live close together in order to derive the advantages of what we have living in a city. And that began to change with the Industrial Revolution was already a fair bit before that. But when we started having rail public transportation, first pulled by horses, actually, and then eventually electric. And that made it possible for people to travel further away from where they worked. And already people sometimes refer to those very first neighborhoods as suburbs of a sort. If you think about old Montreal compared to the Plateau, for example, the Plateau, Mile End, those are neighborhoods that developed as a result. It was possible for them to develop because of the street railways that developed towards the end of the 20th century. And then obviously as automobiles have developed, people have been able to travel further. And as a result of that, our cities have become bigger. Primarily now, almost all my research is dedicated to the collection of transport-related data through emerging technologies, particularly cell phone or smartphones. With that, it's possible then to analyze that information. And that's sort of the second part of the research. One is putting the technologies together in order to be able to collect the data and then to analyze that data and turn it into information.
And what are you trying to figure out by collecting this data exactly?
I think it's relevant to think about what kind of information we're trying to collect and why we're trying to collect it and how it's been done traditionally. So in the transportation planning process, in order to decide whether we should extend a metro, whether we should add another lane of highway, we have two large categories of information that are important. One of which is the transportation system itself, the roads, where the roads go, where the metros go, where the buses go on those roads. And that we call the supply side of the information that's required for doing transportation planning. And then on the other side, we have what's called the demand, so the demand side information. And that's information essentially, at least in a traditional transportation, urban transportation planning context, it's the trips that people make. Where do those trips start? Where do they stop? When do they start and stop? That's very important. The mode of transportation that they use to get from one place to another, as well as the purpose of those trips. So with that information, we can then get a sense of how many people are moving from one place to another at a given time of day. And when we combine that with how much roads there are and how many buses there are, we can get a sense of how many people are on the buses, how long it takes to get from one place to another. And that's the transportation planning problem. We try to improve the system over time by making adjustments either to the system itself on the supply side or possibly on the demand side. You can provide incentives for people to behave differently and travel differently. You can subsidize public transportation, for example, and encourage people to go by public transport instead of by car. So that's the big picture. In order to collect that information, the trips that people make, how many trips they make, where they start, where they end, when they start, when they end, the mode that they use, and the purpose for the travel, we have, since the 1950s, basically had the same system that are called household surveys. In a household survey, especially most recently, those have been done by telephone. So a regional planning authority will hire a survey company. That company will call households on fixed telephones. And the first person who picks up, they ask them sociodemographic questions about themselves and of the household. Then they ask them about their travel behavior. Yesterday, what trips did you make? When you went to work yesterday, what mode did you use? And if you, you know, depending on the mode, if it was by transit, what transit line did you use? And then they would continue and say, okay, well, for the other members of your household, how did they travel yesterday? So there's actually a number of different problems that are being faced now related to this traditional method of collecting the data.
And it's this traditional method of collecting data that would then decide how many roads we'd build and how many buses we'd put on the street. And why was that not sufficient?
There's a number of different issues. If you think about that process where the company calls you up and asks you questions, the first is, in order to be included in this data set, you need to have a fixed telephone. And fewer people have fixed telephones, so that's one issue. Of the people who do have fixed telephones, they're less and less likely to respond, especially with call display. So the proportion of people who are responding to these surveys is decreasing. And to add to that, everybody is not responding in a similar proportion. It turns out that some members of the population respond even less, and in particular, young people who don't have fixed telephones. That's one part of it. One part of it is that it's harder and harder to get a hold of people. The second part of it is that we're losing some people almost entirely from these surveys to try to understand. So not only are the number of trips missing, but we're having more and more trouble getting information about young people and how they travel. There's one other thing that complicates the collection of data in these traditional methods, and that's that when people respond about the trips that they make, they forget some of them. It's not uncommon to forget trips that are non-usual trips. So often people will say, oh, I went to work and then I came home, and they forget the trip that they made to the gym on the way back that they only do twice a week. And so that's a problem. But when people respond on behalf of others in their household, then it's an even bigger problem, right?
So are you saying that you don't even have to ask people for their permission? You just have to tap their phones?
Permission we do have to ask for, and in fact, we're very explicit about that. But the idea is to see if this the smartphone can be used as an instrument to collect information and to get around some of the issues that are being faced from these traditional methods, trip underreporting, for example. And because young people are more likely to have smartphones, maybe we can use that to increase the amount of information that we have about young people and their travel patterns.
So once people have agreed to be part of your survey, then what do you do?
So they download it, you provide your consent. If you don't provide your consent, you can't participate in the survey. Then at the very beginning, there are some questions, sociodemographic questions, age, gender, that type of thing, whether you're a student, whether you're a full-time employee. And if you happen to be a student or a worker, we also ask the location in addition to your where you live, where you work, and where you study. So that information we'll be able to use later on. Associated with those questions are questions about the mode of transport to those locations. So if we can observe that information and use it later on. Then once those questions are done, the application automatically logs people's trips. Our very first large-scale survey we did at Concordia in 2014. We had 900 people who downloaded the app, provided information, and for whom we had good geographical data.
And this was called the Data Mobile Project.
Exactly, yeah. So this whole thing that I'm describing is the Data Mobile Project, and that was the first instantiation of the Data Mobile app. So subsequently, we've got a grant from the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council, but the most recent, we have two surveys that are live right now The one for the city of Montreal is called Montréal Trajet, and that has been it's been live since the 17th of October. We've had more than 10,000 downloads. We can safely say there's thousands of daily users of this application.
But have you come to the point where you can say, aha, we have been underestimating the buses in this area of the city because older people never responded before? Are you able now to take that data and say, and start planning what it means transportation-wise?
In a way, you could with the Concordia study, because it was a population. We knew what the population looked like. We had a sample. We could correct for those differences in people. And that's the idea, that we'll start to be able to do that in the future.
So if you cast your mind way ahead, 50 years from now, what do you see?
I think probably most of the travel-related data collection is going to be automatic. It's going to be without people's intervention, and it'll be pretty accurate.
And in terms of the transportation itself, what do you see?
I think probably a common notion of what the future will look like is something like this. All vehicles will be autonomous. People won't own their own vehicles anymore. They'll just call up a car when they need one. There will be fewer cars, so that's already something that's good. There will be less traffic. And even if there are more cars on the road, because vehicles are autonomous and they're run by robots, they can drive more closely together. Having people drive more closely together is the equivalent of having larger roads. There will be less congestion from that perspective. Maybe all those vehicles will be electric. All these things are good. But in French, they say that with ifs and buts, you can put Paris in a bottle. And there's a lot of ifs and buts in that vision of the future in terms of transportation.
Which is the biggest stumbling block in terms of autonomous vehicles?
This is where I feel like I'm out of sync with kind of most people. But I'm not so sure that truly autonomous vehicles or 100% autonomous vehicles are going to be on the street in 15 years. Maybe 50 years, maybe 100. But there are a lot of challenges to doing that. And one of the challenges is an economic challenge. To get it right, you have to imagine all possible future eventualities that you can write as a program. First of all, that's pretty difficult to understand what all future eventualities will be. So maybe you can get a lot of them pretty close to right. But after that, you know, what do you do with the difference? A very common example that we have is airlines and airline pilots. So the airline industry has invested billions and billions and billions of dollars into making airplanes autonomous, basically. But we still have pilots, and we still use them. In fact, there's a really high proportion of flights that have human interventions for these kind of corner cases, these situations that are difficult to predict beforehand, a series of different circumstances that happen at the same time, where it's easier for a human with our intuition and creativity to connect the dots than it is for a computer that hasn't been programmed for that specific situation. I think there's a challenge also associated with people actually liking to drive. I think that's an element to it. I think it's probably true that people would be reluctant to get into the back seat of a car and let it go its own way. I mean, there are those kinds of challenges. I'm thinking mostly on the technical and economic. It's not at all clear to me that people will not choose to have their own cars, because we've actually had autonomous vehicles for a long time, and we call them taxi cabs. And people don't have their own cars and drivers. And so maybe if the cost of the drivers goes down, you know, maybe you just have your own autonomous vehicle. So maybe everyone will still have cars, they just will be autonomous, so that's a possibility. And it's also possible that if it's so easy to drive to get from one place to another, then maybe people will drive more and maybe we'll have more congestion, especially if people decide to keep their cars and we still have to park them somewhere. You know?
Hence, we really don't know what the future will,
exactly.
There's, will look like.
At least I don't. I really don't know.
In this episode, I spoke with Zach Patterson about the ins and outs of public transportation and how we'll get around town in the future. Join me next week in 2067. 2067 was created and produced by the Thinking Out Loud team at Concordia University. Thanks to Concordia's researchers, guests, and our host, Francine Pelletier. For more 2067 episodes and other Thinking Out Loud podcasts, check out our website, concordia.ca/TOL.